The View from Inside Gaza, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. More protests and more violence along the border between Gaza and Israel today. At least 60 Palestinians have been killed. We'll get The View from inside the Palestinian territory.
The slow death of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza is not acceptable, and there has to be a way out of this.
At the UN, condemnation for Israeli actions, but not from President Trump's ambassador.
I asked my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has.
The latest from Gaza and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Today was a day of funerals in the Gaza Strip after a bloody confrontation all day yesterday between Palestinians in Gaza and Israeli soldiers on the other side of the Gaza border fence. More than 60 people have been killed, all on the Palestinian side. Nearly all of the deaths were from gunfire by the Israeli military. According to Palestinian officials, more than 2,700 have also been injured. At United Nations headquarters in New York, there were calls for an end to the violence today, but the U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley defended Israel's actions, and she blamed the Palestinian militant group Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, for the bloodshed.
I asked my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has. In fact, the records of several countries here today suggest they would be much less restrained.
My BBC colleague Yolande Nell has been following the story and filed this dispatch from the Israeli side of the Gaza border.
I'm looking across into one of the Palestinian protest camps. There's a flag, a Palestinian flag, flying in the distance, and several white protest tents. But I can tell you there are nothing like the numbers I've seen in this particular protest camp when I've been there in previous weeks. It's relatively calm at the border at the moment, although we have seen Israeli soldiers firing some white trails of tear gas. There was some black smoke of burning tires from the Gaza side a bit earlier on. But the large crowds in Gaza have been at these funerals for the several dozen people who were killed on what was the bloodiest day in Gaza for several years. This was meant to be the final day of 6 weeks of Palestinian demonstrations, what was called the Great March of Return in Gaza. And the reason this was the culmination is because today is what Palestinians call Nakba Day, the day of the catastrophe. It's when they traditionally commemorate the expulsion or the fleeing of more than 700,000 people in fighting that followed the creation of Israel back in 1948. But really, a lot of the violence that took place yesterday, a lot of the anger that was expressed, yes, it was over the U.S. embassy move and how controversial that was, and it was about the issue of Jerusalem. But really, many people were acting as though it was Nakba Day brought forwards. But in previous weeks, we have had people from Hamas going around in cars with loudspeakers, encouraging people to go down to the border. That is not something that we've seen in the past 24 hours. We have had the Hamas leader, Ismail Haniyeh. He left Gaza and went to Egypt, where he's been meeting members of the Egyptian intelligence. A lot of speculation that there is a lot of diplomatic pressure, international pressure being applied to try to calm things down. Even though Israel had said that it was going to close the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, the one commercial crossing between Israel and Gaza, indefinitely, it has now opened that crossing. There have been some supplies going in, and the Rafah border crossing with Egypt has also been opened, and we're told it will stay open for an extended period beyond what was initially imagined at the start of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. So it could be that these kinds of moves as well going on behind the scenes give people in Gaza some kind of hope.
The BBC's Yolande Nell reporting there from the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip. For a perspective from inside Gaza, we turn to Mahimer Abusada. He teaches political science at Gaza's Al-Azhar University. Abusada says the border fence has become a focal point for the clashes.
Some of the Palestinians who are trying to breach the fence, they wanted to tell the Israelis that the slow death that they are facing in the Gaza Strip is not acceptable anymore. They demand a better future for for them and for their families. And that's why they are sending a message of anger toward Israel. Now, whether they succeed in infiltrating the fence or not, they just wanted to tell Israel and to tell the international community that the slow death of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza is not acceptable, and there has to be a way out of this.
Right. Today is the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, or the catastrophe. That was 1948, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled or were expelled from their homes. What does this day mean to you?
It's the most insulting day in the history of the Palestinian people. It's a reminder for the Palestinian that their suffering has continued for the past 70 years. And unfortunately, the international community and the Arab leaders, and as well as the Palestinian leaders, have failed to put an end to their suffering and to restore dignity to those Palestinian refugees.
So you say Palestinian leaders are also guilty of the suffering of the people in Gaza. Who are you specifically pointing a finger at? I mean, Hamas is in charge in Gaza. Are they also responsible?
Palestinian people have paid a very heavy price over the past 70 years. Almost 1 million Palestinians spent time in Israeli jails. And we believe that the Palestinian people deserve a better leadership. Generally speaking, I do blame both the leaders of Hamas, who have not done enough to the advantage of the Palestinian people, and also the Palestinian presidency.
It does sound like there are multiple reasons for these protests in the Gaza Strip. I do want to know about this tactic of charging the fence, the border fence, in waves of people. I mean, why are these protests taking this particular form right now? What's that about?
Palestinian protesters have no actual contact with the Israeli occupation forces, and that's why Palestinian youngsters end up going to the border area between Gaza and Israel to protest against the Israeli occupation, to protest against the Israeli siege and blockade of the Gaza Strip.
I'm just curious, do you have any Israeli friends?
Yes, I do. I have many of them. I have many of them on Facebook. I'm in contact with many of them on the phone, so I don't have any problem with having some Israeli friends.
And on the Israeli side, do you feel like you have allies with you who understand what's going on in Gaza and just the pressure that people who live in Gaza are under?
Definitely, there are many Israelis who are sympathetic to the situation in the Gaza Strip, and they do criticize their own government. But unfortunately, what exists in Israel is a government that represents the most extreme Israelis who do not pay attention to the economic and social needs of the Palestinian people who are under Israeli occupation.
What do you think about these protests? Are they likely to grow or fade or take a new form?
Yesterday was the deadliest of all the past 5 months. And the organizers of this protest are calling for the continuation of this protest until June 5th. So we do expect that this nonviolent protest will continue for about 20 more days, but I believe it's going to be less intensity.
No doubt this is some kind of watershed moment, and there's so much anger right now. There's so much emotion. It's hard to imagine the phrase Mideast peace process, much less Mideast peace right now. So tell us, what do you think is the way forward?
Unfortunately, there is no enough will on the international community to step in and put enough pressure on Israel to put an end to its occupation and its bad treatment of the Palestinians. We would really like to work together in order to live in peace and security, and it will have to come from the Israeli society itself. I think the Israelis will have to change their own government. They will have to put in a government that is ready to make peace with the Palestinians, that is ready to make compromise with the Palestinians. If Israel and the Israelis are interested in peace and security, they have to come up with a compromise with the Palestinians so both people can live in peace and security.
Professor Mahimer Abousada teaches political science at Gaza's Al-Azhar University. He was speaking with us from Gaza City. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
As American and Chinese negotiators sit down this week to talk trade, remember three letters, ZTE. That's a Chinese multinational telecommunications company, just the kind of Chinese giant that President Trump wanted to target with crippling trade sanctions, until he didn't. In a recent tweet, Trump said he wanted to negotiate a deal with China to exempt ZTE from sanctions, and in an odd, Make China Great Again moment, Trump wrote, too many Chinese jobs lost. Okay, so while the officials wheel and deal, how do ordinary Chinese feel about the budding trade war between Washington and Beijing? Isaac Stonefish is just back from a reporting trip to China and has been asking that question. Hey, Isaac.
Hey, Marco.
So set the scene for us. I know you went to the biggest Starbucks in Shanghai to take the pulse of this issue. Why there?
So I went to the biggest Starbucks in the world, which the Starbucks company decided to open in Shanghai as an indication of how important China is to the future of Starbucks. And I decided to do this reporting in Starbucks because I thought it was a really good example of a company that came from nowhere to be massively successful in the Chinese market. Chinese were traditionally not coffee drinkers. They invented tea. And then starting roughly a decade ago, Starbucks became the symbol for sophisticated urbanism. And I wanted to see how much Chinese consumers associated Starbucks with America and with the political tensions and how much of it was just a good cup of coffee for them.
So tell us about the first person you met, Helen Zhang. Who is she?
So Helen caught my eye because she was studying Hebrew, which is not something that you see very often in a Chinese Starbucks. And she was Christian and wanted to study Hebrew to get closer to the Bible. And she had views that, although she presented them very carefully, were more critical of China's ruling Communist Party than most people publicly are.
We Chinese have been kept in the dark about the trade dispute between China and the U.S., and many people have no idea what changes the government's actions would bring. Here, a lot of media coverage is not as open. It was quite controlled. Most people will believe whatever the government is telling them. Sometimes when we're looking for information, we need to circumvent the wall.
So when Helen talks about the wall, she's not talking about the Great Wall of China. She's talking about what?
The Great Firewall of China, the massive censorship apparatus that hangs over the Chinese internet.
So there's this feeling of being kept in the dark in China about what a trade war with the U.S. might really bring. Tell us about the other woman you met.
So the other woman, Joy Jiang, was a lot more positive about the direction that U.S.-China relations were going. And she was also a lot more of the type who normally speaks to Western reporters like myself. She was a lot more upbeat, more comfortable saying nice things about both of the countries because she didn't want to wade into anything political.
A lot of Chinese kids are studying abroad now, not to mention the number of kids who are studying in the States. Many have excelled at school and have chosen to return to China to find work in bilateral trade. I think this is a good trend and will continue in the future.
So you're right, Isaac. She's pretty optimistic, and it seems that she's having a hard time imagining a trade war. But if there were, I mean, would she consider boycotting Starbucks, for example?
I was curious about that, too, and I asked her the same question.
I don't think it's necessary to boycott Starbucks because it's provided a lot of employment opportunities here. It's also provided a chance for Chinese people to learn about coffee culture. We feel very special after coming here.
How representative do you feel these kinds of views are, Isaac?
With the caveat that one almost has to generalize here. You know, we're talking about a country with 1.4 billion people. I would say Joy's views were fairly common, especially that she knew that she was being recorded and that this was going on the record. I would think her views would be slightly more nuanced and perhaps a little bit more critical of Starbucks or of Chinese trade policy had the recorder been put away.
Yeah, so she'll always know what a venti is, huh?
That she will. No one can take that away from her.
International Affairs Analyst Isaac Stonefish, thanks as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Just ahead on the show, a Colombian news anchor straightens things out by embracing her curls. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Yesterday, we told you about Egyptian women staging a comeback for naturally curly hair after years of being pressured to straighten it. Well, here's another story from our curly hair files. Yeah, apparently there's a desk for that. This one comes from Colombia. Mabel Lara is a top TV news anchor there, and she recently stunned viewers, appearing on screen wearing her hair naturally, which in her case means curly. Lara had never done that in her previous two decades on TV. She'd always straightened her curls because, well, that was the norm for all female anchors. We wanted to know why Mabel Lara decided to go with her curls, so we asked her via WhatsApp, and here's some of her answer.
Desde hace cuatro años, en un episodio cuando estaba en el Mundial de Fútbol.
4 years ago, something happened when I was working at the World Cup in Brazil. I decided to dye and straighten my hair while I was there. And it ended up really damaged. Let's say it was a big risk. And from there, I started feeling tired after more than 20 years of straightening my hair. So I started thinking about when to stop. Fortunately, my directors thought it was a good idea. To them, it seemed like an interesting way not only to have me look good and freshened up, but also reclaim everything that I represent. As an Afro-Colombian woman, you don't necessarily think of curly hair as a burden. It's simply the way it is, and you learn to live with it. But still, when you go to the hair salon, they tell you they can't handle curly hair, that they don't know how to deal with it. And they also say, oh, your hair isn't that bad. It's a little better than the rest, because I'm mixed race. It's something you're forced to deal with since you're a little girl. People telling you what you have to do with your curly hair. From the time I was 15, always having to look good, which means having to just always straighten your hair. And then in my case, being in front of a TV camera, every single day having to blow dry my hair to be able to straighten it. So what's my message to other women? That you've got to search inside and ask yourself, what is it that I want? How do I want to see myself? How do I accept myself? How do I try to show that beauty isn't just what we've always been told, but that there's beauty even in these big curls? When I started my career, I couldn't have taken this liberty to go on air with a natural look. Back then, I had to belong, and belonging meant straightening my hair. Now I feel free to send this message to say, hey, I'm done. I don't want to straighten my hair anymore. My hair's curly. I can do what I want with it. Maybe even shave it off someday. I see it as a small battle, a way to push so we can change stereotypes.
Colombian TV anchor Mabel Lara talking about her recent decision to stop straightening her hair when she goes on air. Her comments were translated and voiced by producer Amanda Kersey. Age, it's just a number, right? It's what we tell ourselves. But ask the Rolling Stones. They're in their 70s now, and they're still at it, it being making music. The band's about to go on tour again. Mick and Keith took time out of rehearsing to speak with my colleague, the BBC's entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones' first UK shows for 5 years. What is it that makes the band want to keep coming back?
But you know, we enjoy what we do, obviously. I don't think anyone's that reluctant. Ronnie, I think, wants to be, or they'd like to be on the road all the time with their two little children. but he doesn't prevail.
Would you want to take your kids on tour?
Not permanently. No. No.
Keith Richards, yeah. What is it like for you being on stage?
It's, I get this weird feeling that I'm at home when I get up there. I mean, after so long, it's really the home away from home. And it's Ronnie and I go up there and say, come on, let's go and get some peace and quiet. You know?
How much do you still love being a rock star?
It's difficult. I mean, I've really done very little else in my life. It seems a bit limiting, really, if you think about it. I mean, I've mainly done that since I was 19, so it's a very sort of cloistered, weird existence. So I'm very happy to do it, but I don't really know about much else.
You almost sound slightly wistful as you say that.
So wistful, but someone sent me one of my first interviews with, must have been like a sort of teenage magazine. They used to ask you, you know, your favourite colours and your favourite clothes and how do you like being a rock star and all that. I was reading that yesterday. And here we are still doing that and here you're still asking me, what's it like to be a rock star?
How did you answer it then?
It's a dream come true. Something like that. Everywhere I hear the sound of
this year, it's 50 years since Street Fighting Man, which is still in the set often, and that is a song that was about protests in London and Paris. What are your memories of writing that song?
It was just appropriate at the time, 68, I think it was. Paris was going bananas, and we'd just been there. And actually, I wrote the song off of the sound of French police sirens. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Time is right for
ballet. What still gets you angry?
These days, nothing. I just can't be bothered, quite honestly, to waste the energy on anger. I've got nothing to be angry about, man, you know. I mean, it'd almost be gratuitous for me to get angry, you know, about anything, you know. What, you've burnt the toast? You know, I mean, what am I going to get angry about?
It's quite an angry-sounding track, but the lyrics are more resigned to the status quo somewhat.
Is that how you feel now?
Well, I'm not really happy about the status quo. I'm talking about the UK, obviously, and I'll restrict myself to that.
Well, you did end up in a very interesting moment when, without any permission, I should say, Donald Trump used "You Can't Always Get What You Want" during his victory speech. You can't always get
what you want. He used it on everything. He used it on every rally through the election campaign. I wasn't the DJ, obviously, but if I was Donald's DJ, it's good, it's my line. It's a funny song for your play-out song. So when he finished the speech, he played this out on this sort of doomy ballad about drugs in Chelsea. It's kind of weird if you think about it, but he couldn't be persuaded to use something else. It was an odd thing, really odd. Try sometimes, will you just fight
by? You get what you need. One Donald Trump story relating to the Stones I heard. 1989, the Steel Wheels tour. Apparently, he once tried to crash a press conference. You weren't too happy. Do you remember any of that?
He was the promoter for us in Atlantic City. And then we got to Atlantic City. Donald Trump presents the Rolling Stones in miniature. And we never have much to do with promoters, you know, usually. But this one got me. That was the last time I got angry. I pulled out my trusty blade, stuck it in the table and said, "You've got to get rid of this man."
Oof, the Rolling Stones' Keith Richards ending that report by the BBC's Colin Patterson. I'm Marco Werman. A series of bombings in Indonesia are carried out by members of just one family, father, mother, and four kids, the youngest just 9 years old.
Most comments on social media were kind of shocked, knowing that there are parents who could do this.
Hear more of that unreal story that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Marco, I know you speak French, right?
Yeah.
And for a while, didn't you speak French exclusively with your daughter at home?
That's Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words. And yes, Patrick, I did. Her mom and I thought, why not give our kid a head start in a foreign language? But, you know, it all fell apart when she was about three or four because I had a hard time being stern in French, and she didn't want to be spoken to in French among her English friends. So, yeah, that was that.
I mean, she knew that you spoke English. It was your native tongue, right?
Yeah, absolutely. She heard both languages.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like so many people have stories about trying to introduce a second language. My wife and I tried a little bit of that with our daughter speaking Mandarin. She does speak Chinese, but not really with us. And someone else who's tried to do this is our friend Alina Simone. She was born in what was then the Soviet Union, moved to this country as a child, now lives in New York City. We invited Alina to talk about this recently at a live recording of The World in Words that we did at a branch of the New York Public Library.
And that's what we're going to listen to right now.
Alina is a writer. She's a musician. And she's bilingual. Tell us about the bilingual bit.
I wouldn't give myself too much credit for that. I'd thank my parents. I grew up under a very strict linguistic regime, speaking Russian. My parents had a rule, only Russian in the house. This was during the Cold War, so like unless you wanted to grow up to be a Kremlinologist, it wasn't a really popular choice for a second language. So I resented it a lot, and there were a lot of fights. I tried to subvert their rule by taking various vows of silence.
Nice.
It didn't last long.
So did all of this hate, did it turn into love at some point? I mean, it must have done. You speak Russian.
It did turn into love when the Iron Curtain came down and we all came to love Russians, briefly at least.
Briefly, yes.
There was a flowering. There was a time when we could finally see what this mysterious country was like. And suddenly, I was in college. Suddenly, all my American friends were like going to Moscow for the summer and having these cool experiences. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm Russian. I can do this. And I started to really invest time in my Russian and getting good at it, to the point where I could get a job there. And it ended up bringing my family a lot closer together because suddenly I had a much better understanding of all these mysterious forces that shaped them.
So the struggles of your early learning actually paid off in the end.
They did. And we had this cliched and heartwarming happy ending. Until my daughter was born, and then it was back to the unhappy beginning again.
It requires constant work. Those kids, they speak only Russian at home. And they said the lady.
This is my mom trying to help, explaining how her friend's daughter did it, passed her Russian on to her kids, third generation speakers. And this is my mom playing with my daughter Zoe, speaking Russian to her, singing a Russian song as she rocks her on a bed. This was a few years ago when Zoe was 2. The pressure to pass Russian on to Zoe didn't just come from my family. It came from everyone and everywhere, from friends and colleagues and random parents at the park and those ubiquitous studies on how language learning helps brain plasticity. I mean, if you're fluent in a language, why would you not pass it on to your kid? It would mean I was lazy or that I didn't care about my family heritage or all the benefits, that I was just like a bad mom. So I listened to all these voices. I taught my daughter Russian. But 6 years later, sitting here watching it die, I have to admit, I kind of wish I didn't.
How about I ate pancakes for breakfast? Don't hold it right up to your mouth, though. Yeah.
Yeah, ела блинчики. Yeah.
На.
На.
You say breakfast.
На.
Завтрак. I'm pretty sure 6 months ago she knew the word for breakfast, завтрак. Everyone always talks about the benefits of language learning. No one talks about the trade-offs. Of course, it was exciting to watch my daughter absorb 2 languages effortlessly and impress all those babushkas on New York City buses. And when she was a toddler, while the conversations revolved around boo-boos and sippy cups and teddy bears, it was easy for me too. But as she got older, the sacrifices got bigger, and the benefits began to feel questionable. First, there was her dad, my husband, a non-Russian-speaking American who felt left out of the whole mother-daughter secret language project. Then there was the rising tide of English, which was constantly threatening to swamp my little Russian life raft with waves of SpongeBob and Shopkins. And then there was just me. As my daughter got older, and wanted to have conversations that went beyond the shiny thing right in front of her, I struggled to keep up. I'd watch her playing make-believe with her dad or laughing at his jokes and feel jealous. It made me confront some uncomfortable truths. I'm not funny in Russian. I can't say all the things I want to say. I can't really be who I am. So if I insisted on being Zoe's Russian teacher, then she would grow up not really knowing her mom. I made a decision and told my mom.
I am giving up on Russian. Well, it's what can I say? It's your choice. I would have never, ever done it.
Meaning, she never stopped speaking Russian to me, and I shouldn't stop using it with Zoe.
Because she already has it, and all you need is to keep it up.
But it just got harder and harder to keep it up.
Oh,
because,
of course.
But let me just finish. Yeah. Let me just finish.
Vocabulary is 3 years ago, when Russian began to feel like a struggle, I found out an acquaintance of mine, Anya Yulinich, who left Russia when she was 17 and was far more fluent than me. She hadn't taught either of her kids Russian. Whenever I felt bad about letting Zoe's language slip, it felt good to remind myself that there were other moms out there like me, moms like Anya. But I was also curious. I mean, her Russian was so good. Wouldn't it be easy for her? Did she ever consider speaking to her kids in Russian?
Yes, there was definitely an expectation in my family that I would. And I disappointed my family by not doing it.
Like me, Anya was married to an American, and like me, the rest of her Russian-speaking family lived far away. But I assumed that the fact that Anya had gone to school in Russia and was a much better speaker than me would take away all the friction that I was experiencing. It didn't.
I think that people look at language and at raising bilingual children and they think of it as a kind of a technical issue. So they think of language as by itself, apart from the culture, right? And I think language is very connected to that native culture. I'm not raising my children in that culture.
Amen, sister. For one thing, the Russian language itself has evolved, probably more rapidly than most, since our families left Russia. Anya and I speak an antique variant of Soviet Russian, pre-internet.
So if I were to talk to my kid about her report card or even what she has for dinner, I wouldn't know how to describe...
A burrito?
Well, right, a burrito or, you know, I don't know. How do you say ramen in Russian? How do you say avocado? Probably avocado. But it's not for the lack of vocabulary alone. It's that I cannot divorce the language from the culture. And I wasn't the happiest of children. For me, when I speak Russian, I time travel to some past self of myself that is not me culturally and just not me.
The decision to not pass on a language has so many different components. Logistics, psychology. Also, sometimes there's no time for translation. You just need to get the words out as fast as possible. Like,
don't throw your sister out the window usually comes out in English. It's not like, how do I see, you know, let me construct this sentence.
When I try to describe these kinds of challenges for my mother, nothing seems to work. She's convinced that whatever the hassle or sacrifice, I can seek out local Russian speakers and create my own little Russia for Zoe. And I start to get the feeling it's not really about Zoe, how much Russian will magically expand her brain or all the great career opportunities it will open for her 20 years from now. It's something much more important.
Is there something personal about it? Like if Zoya couldn't speak Russian at all, that you would feel disconnected from her?
A little bit, yeah. Well, we can communicate in English, but for whatever reason, the cultural difference is huge, and we both, and not just us, lots of other people we know, they never do it when they don't, absolutely don't have to.
They speak in English?
Yes, there is a disconnect, definitely.
It's not about Zoe knowing Russian, I suspect. It's about Zoe knowing her grandmother and her grandfather, who perhaps only feel like their true selves when they're speaking their native language. And I get it. That's a big deal. but we're just going to have to find another way. Because the truth is, we were always doomed to fail. At least, that's what research tells us. With only one native speaker in the family, passing on a foreign language, not just for a couple years, but permanently and at a high level of fluency while living in an English-speaking community, is, if not impossible...
It's a very, very difficult endeavor. The United States is the graveyard of, well, we call it foreign languages, but, you know, languages other than English.
This is Richard Alba, a sociology professor at the City University of New York's Graduate Center, who has studied linguistic assimilation. For most American immigrants, Richard tells me, the language of their native country is gone by the third generation.
Languages survive best, you know, when young people find a use for them. And unless they can see a need for that language, they're going to speak English with their friends.
I have to admit, Professor Alba started out as my expert interviewee, but he kind of segued into the role of therapist. Sorry, Richard.
Well, I think your family in its kind of intergenerational transitions is going through processes that have happened over and over and over again in the United States. English has a power. It makes it very hard for young people to resist swimming in an English language world.
As a busy working mom, I have to admit, the path of least resistance sounds pretty good. In our case, oddly enough, it led to another language. This is Zoe and some of her school friends singing in Chinese. They're standing in line, all wearing white shirts. They're in front of a huge painting of a lake and rolling green hills. A little slice of China right here in New York City. And I've no idea what she's singing. I hope it's radio friendly. Since kindergarten, she's attended a Mandarin bilingual public school here on the Lower East Side. She loves it, says Chinese is her favorite subject. And while the Russian experiment was kind of a divisive thing in our family, my husband and I both believe knowing a second language is awesome, and the best time to learn a language is definitely when you're young. That's where we're at. But for my friend Anya, it seems like the pendulum has swung back around. Her younger daughter has decided to take up, yeah, Russian.
She has Russian friends who speak Russian. She also is interested in, you know, our family history. She's just interested.
Anya's daughter is now 17, the same age Anya was when she came to the U.S., speaking no English. At a certain point, your kids are no longer the blank screen for the movie you scripted. They're simply themselves. And the movie, it never got made.
It's as though everything we do with our children is hugely consequential. The children, though, they live in a wider world. And I think at the age of 13 or 12, it just stops. People are just like, you still alive? We have some food. Did you do your homework? And don't get into trouble and keep your phone charged.
That's it. Your parenting book could fit on a note card.
Basically.
Nowadays, at our place, there's less stress, more laughs. Sometimes at night, Zoe and I will have a tea party with my Russian grandmother's old porcelain cups, and I'll tell her stories about the motherland, which really feels more like the grandmotherland, even to me at this point. To her, it's all a little weird and exotic, like a fairy tale with Stalin as the dragon. She loves it. And I let myself feel sad from time to time, too, as her Russian words slip away one by one. As for my parents, they've started Skyping with Zoe on Thursdays. Even though she can still understand Russian, I notice they mostly speak English to her. I haven't asked about it. Assimilation can tear down walls, but in the case of immigrants and their grandkids, it throws them up, too. Looking back, when they forced me to speak Russian as a kid, I think they mostly did that for themselves. But they're speaking English for Zoe, because they don't want to be on the other side of that wall. And when it's a choice between love and language, love will always win.
That is a great moral to that story, and I will keep that in mind. Alina Simone there, recorded at the Andrel High School branch of the New York Public Library. You can hear many more stories about people and languages in our podcast, The World in Words, available on your favorite podcast app and at pri.org/language. Our next story is pretty shocking. You may have heard about the suicide bombings in Indonesia on Sunday. Three Christian churches were attacked in the city of Surabaya. The number of casualties was relatively low for these kind of events. What's shocking is who did it.
A family, a single family. Father, mother, two sons, 16 and 18 years old, and two little daughters, 9 and 11 years old. Those four children all died.
That's Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch in Jakarta. Another family of five carried out a suicide attack yesterday at a police checkpoint. Their 8-year-old daughter somehow survived. A third family was ripped apart in their home in what appears to have been a premature explosion.
These three families all are friends. They belong to a single organization called JAD, which is a splinter group of the Jamaah Islamiyah. Jamaah Islamiyah was linked to Al-Qaeda. JAD pledged allegiance to the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I've heard reports that some of these people, I don't know if it's entire families, but certainly some of these fighters had returned from Syria or Iraq. What do we know about that for sure?
Hundreds of them have returned, not all of them. But those three families did not go to Iraq, to Syria. But of course, the three of them have friends who went to Syria. And apparently they learned their bomb-making skill. One of the fathers learned the bomb-making skill apparently from those who went to Syria.
So what is the popular view among Indonesians? I know this happened just over the weekend, so maybe it's hard to gauge.
Most comments on social media were kind of shocked knowing that there are parents who could do this, including conservative Muslim. They are shocked to know this kind of actions. It is difficult to believe that, you know, dads and mom bring you to a trip with bombs, committing this kind of violence. Although another explanation says they go to heaven. The fact that the mother helped her children putting on the fast and believing that they will all go to heaven. And so that kind of explanation is strange, but it is now circulating.
Well, Andreas, I mean, you're an official with Human Rights Watch. What is your assessment of how vulnerable Christians and other minorities are in Indonesia today?
Well, this bombing takes place as religious freedom for minorities, including Christian, including Muslim minorities like the Shia, like the Ahmadiyya, or other smaller religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, local faith. They suffer hundreds of attacks over the last 15 years at the least. Obviously, they are scared. Churches, they are scared. Many Sunday services were canceled after the bombing. And even today, I went to Starbucks. Usually, you know, Starbucks is packed, 30, 40 people, customers. Today, the barista were sitting idle. You can find many empty chairs in Starbucks or bigger malls.
And are you saying that's the case because people are scared to congregate in a single place, like a single Western place like Starbucks?
Obviously. People are scared. I went to my daughter's school today, and a mother, a Christian, said that her husband basically, quote-unquote, scolded me for keeping going to the church despite the bombing because her husband was so worried. I think this is a common feeling among Christians in Indonesia. And this is not only because of the bombing, because the violence against Christian, closure of their churches, burning of their churches, more than 1,000 of their churches were closed down over the last 15 years. You know, churches in Indonesia are not that many. closing down 1,000 is quite a lot.
Yeah, so it sounds like the Christian minority in Indonesia is scared. Andreas, we don't hear a lot of news from Indonesia here in the U.S. We do know it's the most populous Muslim country in the world, and I'm just curious, how do Indonesians view the U.S. these days, and how much concern is there for the headlines that Donald Trump has been making with his rhetoric about keeping Muslims out of the U.S.?
Oh, they hate it. They hate it so much. They thought that this is an unstable president in the U.S., replacing Barack Obama. You know that Barack Obama grew up in Jakarta.
Right.
They speak Indonesian, know how to say nasi goreng, bakso, all Indonesian food. So Obama was obviously very popular in Indonesia. And suddenly, the U.S. has Donald Trump, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, banning Muslims to enter the U.S. It's not good news here.
Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch in Jakarta. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
There's a man from West Africa who understands the concerns of those Indonesians. Bombino comes from the Tuareg ethnicity in Niger. He's a guitarist, a great guitarist, really. And thanks to that talent, Bombino had something to whisk him out of Niger. Rebels and extremists in Niger, in Mali, really across the entire Sahel, forced Bombino to consider where he was going to make music. He spent a lot of the recent years outside Niger in exile and found solace in his guitar, practicing a lot, and he only gets better. We'll leave you with a taste of his new album, comes out today, Deran. It's a hopeful title, means best wishes in Bombino's Tamashek language, and we're just loving this track, Majagan. Bombino calls his style Tuarege. Of course. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, and best wishes to you.
RI, Public Radio International.